Now, Meet the Press. Today's guest on Meet the Press is John G. Tower, the first Republican ever elected by Texas voters to serve in the United States Senate. And with him, ready for an unrehearsed discussion, are the members of this week's panel: Sarah McClendon, El Paso Times; Raymond Brandt, St. Louis Post-Dispatch; Richard Wilson, Kohl's Publications; and Robert Abernathy, NBC News. Here is our moderator, Ned Brooks.
For the first time in 84 years, the state of Texas has a Republican in the United States Senate. Mr. John G. Tower was sworn in on Thursday. He occupies the seat given up by Lyndon Johnson when he became vice president. Senator Tower, who is our guest today, also has the distinction of being the youngest member of the present Senate. In the special election in April, Senator Tower led the field of 71 candidates. He then went on to win the runoff against Democratic Senator William Blakely. Senator Tower is a former college professor and radio newscaster. In World War II, he was on combat duty in the Pacific. And now we're ready to start the questions, Mr. Abernathy.
Senator, you've been described as a man whose political philosophy lies somewhere between that of William McKinley and Alfred the Great. You call yourself a conservative. As a former professor of government, can you give us a brief definition of what you mean by the word conservative?
Well, of course, in the field of academic political science, there are several accepted definitions of conservatism that apply in different cases. Now, our peculiar American variety of conservatism, or I should say the variety that is indigenous to America, would, I think, go something like this. I believe that the conservative in the United States is one who wants to preserve our existing constitutional and legal system, one who wants to preserve our capitalist economy, one who wants to preserve the federal character of the republic. He's one who believes that, to perhaps simplify it a little bit, as Thomas Jefferson, that government is best which governs least. He opposes the centralization of too much power in the hands of the national government. He favors the devolution of power and responsibility on state and local government. He opposes high taxation and high spending. His concept is one that is basically libertarian, or with the accent on liberty, rather than with the accent on equality.
In one of your pieces of campaign literature, this was written: he, referring to you, speaks out for a dynamic free economy instead of the socialistic liberalism of the new frontier. Do you think that the president or any of his advisors are what you would call socialistic?
No, I wouldn't call the president socialistic. I believe that there are socialistic tendencies inherent in the proposals and programs of the administration. And as to some of his advisors, I would say probably intellectually they are socialist. I couldn't say with certitude that they are, but I believe them to be because of the things that they advocate. I think that what would be established by the implementation of the New Frontier programs would be a tendency towards socialism. After all, the Fabian socialists in England, for example, were very patient, very persevering. They didn't try to accomplish socialism overnight. They did it over a period of many years, or their idea was to accomplish it a little bit at a time.
Mrs. McClendon.
Senator Tower, do you think that Texas people oppose getting all those millions and millions in federal benefits that the Democratic congressmen have been giving them all these years? Why do you think they voted for you?
I think that that Texans generally, now of course in certain specified areas they are glad to get federal help, but I think Texans generally are currently in opposition to big spending. Now during my campaign I would say to them, I do not see it as my function in Washington to try to secure for Texas the expenditure of as much federal money in Texas as possible. I said that I believe that my function will be to try to save you money, because the government doesn't give you anything it doesn't first take from you. In other words, the government comes down here and taxes us and takes the money from us, and then it's expended again in the state. I think that expenditures can best be made and more efficiently and economically made on the local level, that is to say with sources relinquished to local and state authorities to the extent that they can levy these taxes.
sir, when your constituents come up here and ask for these big sums annually for their water dams and their rivers, are you going to tell them to go back home and get the funds at home?
Conceivably, in certain situations I might. In others, I might not. Now, I regard some things as legitimately the function of the national government. Certainly, the maintenance of our military bases is a function of the national government. And I believe that because the Texan climate is a good climate, because the topography and the good all-round flying weather in Texas lends itself to military operations, I think it's logical that military bases should be located there. I certainly approve of projects like the Canadian River project, where the people of that area are borrowing the money from the national government to be paid back at an established rate of interest. They're paying for 97% of the program, and the government only 3% for reclamation and conservation. And I think programs of this type are valid. I think that pilot programs like the saline water conversion project in Freeport are valid federal projects. There are some that I think perhaps are useless pork barrel expenditures. I think we have to judge each case on its merits.
Mr. Brandt.
Senator, we've often been told that Texas is an exceptional state. Wasn't your election exceptional? The reason I ask that is this. We've heard many times after your election that Texas is now a two-party state. Was not your election exceptional?
Yes, my election was exceptional. I think in light of the fact that no Republican has ever been popularly elected in Texas on a statewide basis except in presidential elections, that is to say, in a state candidate, that it is exceptional. But I think it indicates a trend. I think, of course, Texans like to show people of the country they're still capable of doing the unusual, as Texans have been doing for these many years. And I think it indicates a trend toward a two-party system in Texas. We have been making great gains over the past decade. Our leadership in Texas is young and vigorous, ambitious. The people who elected me, or I should say the people who provided the main part of the effort that elected me, were for the most part housewives working on the precinct and block level, who were dedicated to the cause of good government as they saw it, and who ask for no reward and no patronage.
Well, your platform and that of Senator Blakely, there was very little difference in the platform. You were both conservatives.
They were similar in most respects, yes.
Was it a matter of personalities?
Oh, I don't think so so much. I think that people felt they could rely on me to be a little bit more independent. I owed no allegiance to any political clique or group. I was, I think, somewhat more vigorous in asserting my cause than Mr. Blakely was his. And two, back last fall, Mr. Blakely was one of the large contributors to the New Frontier campaign. And I simply raised the question, what is a New Frontier conservative?
Well, to make Texas a two-party state, a lot of Democrats will have to switch.
Yes, that's true.
You switched, did you not?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I voted in the Democratic primary in 1948. I have never voted for a Democrat for president. About 10 years ago, I decided that the Republican Party nationally represented my political views more closely than did the Democratic Party, and so I decided it was time to switch. Discontent with the one-party political stagnation in our state. I think that every state should have a two-party system, and I've been working toward that end.
Well, now, to have a two-party state, you must have organization.
Yes, sir.
Now, what have you done to establish the grassroots organization for the Republican Party?
We have been most successful in the urban areas. We have gone in at the precinct and block level. First, we have got the most able precinct chairman that we could find in the voting precincts. Then we've gone down to the block level and gotten people to work as block captains. In our campaigns, we have employed, I think, very successfully, in my campaign in particular, the technique of door-to-door personal contacts, telephones, and direct mailings, these things that require a lot of volunteers. In the urban areas, we have been very successful, I think, in developing a grassroots organization. We have been less successful in the rural and small town areas, but I think that we're going to see some improvement in
that.
What
appeal can you make
to the low-income voters. I understand Texas still has a poll tax.
That's correct. Texas does. What appeal can I make to the low-income voters? Well, I believe that our appeal, that is to say the conservative appeal, is basically sound, because I believe that in creating a free climate for the conduct of business and preserving the capitalist system as free of government intervention and regimentation as possible, that everyone will benefit, including the low-income worker. After all, look how good the capitalist system has been to the low-income people in our country. They have a higher standard of living than people in middle and high-income brackets in most countries of this world.
Mr. Wilson.
Senator, do you accept the leadership in the Republican Party of former Vice President Nixon, of Governor Rockefeller, or of Senator Goldwater?
Well, this question would assume that there are three clearly defined factions in the Republican Party, each led by one of these gentlemen. I don't recognize such a factional breakdown in the Republican Party, and I don't believe many Republican leaders or participants do. As far as political philosophy is concerned, of course, I'm very close to Barry Goldwater. I am also a friend of Vice President Nixon's. I have received some good counsel and advice from him. I have met Governor Rockefeller and find him a very personable and charming person. I imagine that we tend to disagree on a great number of issues.
I wondered if you considered Governor Rockefeller to be a good Republican.
I don't believe that Governor Rockefeller's views would represent a consensus of Republican viewpoint, because I believe it would be substantially to the right of his.
Yes. Well, do you think the consensus is represented by Mr. Nixon or Mr. Goldwater?
I think that right now the consensus is conservative. I think it would be wrong for me to try to define either Mr. Nixon's or Mr. Goldwater's political philosophy. And then say it's closer to this one or that one. I believe that it is generally conservative. One thing that shores up my belief is what happened in the platform committee in Chicago during the summer. I think the general orientation was conservative, and the people that I've talked to seem to be conservative. The members of Congress and the Senate that I have talked to seem to be conservative.
Well, there was one point on which they might not be conservative, Senator. Let me suggest to you that the civil rights plank in the platform was not a conservative section. And since that time, the Republican leadership and some individual Republican senators have been very critical of the Kennedy administration for failing to back civil rights legislation at this session of Congress. I wondered if you'd join them in criticizing the Kennedy administration for that.
No, sir, I wouldn't join them in criticizing the Kennedy administration for that. Now, actually, I don't think that the civil rights issue as such is a liberal or conservative, divides along liberal and conservative lines. I know some people who are very conservative in their political thinking who advocate more civil rights legislation. On the other hand, you'll find some Southern senators and congressmen who vote liberally. Economic issues, state versus federal government issues, but are what you might call conservative on the civil rights issue. I don't think it's really a liberal conservative issue.
But the typical situation is that a conservative Southern Democrat is opposed to civil rights legislation.
I'd say most liberal Southern Democrats are, too.
Yes, well, there are some that are not opposed to
it. Yes, there are a few who are not opposed to it. I think that that Southerners of goodwill, Southerners of moderation, feel that the civil rights problems can best be resolved gradually over a period of years in an atmosphere of goodwill, and that this atmosphere cannot exist as long as there is too much intervention from the outside.
The reason I asked the question was I wanted to suggest to you the possibility that you find yourself in a very small minority in the Republican Party, that you and Senator Goldwater comprise what you might call the hard core of a very small minority. Is that a valid conclusion?
I wouldn't say that's a valid conclusion, no, sir.
Well, what is a valid conclusion?
What do you mean? You mean, who is the minority or what?
Yes, I'm suggesting to you that you're in a very small minority and that the larger part of the Republican Party is far more liberal than you are.
It's possible that a majority of the Republican Party is more liberal than I am, but I think, too, that a majority of the Republican Party is closer to the conservative position than to the liberal position. I would say that the consensus would lie somewhere between center and right. I may happen to be on the right end of the spectrum, but I think that the spectrum generally ranges from center to right.
Senator, Senator Goldwater says that a Republican nominee is likely to be someone who is not now in the picture, 64. Do you think that is correct?
I think that's altogether possible. I think it's really a little bit too early to be talking about 64. I think that most Republicans that I have talked to, and certainly our party leadership, are now preoccupied with the congressional races of 62. They're not really thinking much about 64 at this time.
Do you think the nominee will be a conservative?
I think the nominee will be one who expresses conservative views, relatively conservative in any case.
Mr. Abernathy.
Senator, in the light of what you've said about building a Republican Party in Texas, one of the interesting things about a piece of campaign literature of yours that I was given in your office is that the word Republican is never mentioned in it. Why was this?
In Texas, we felt the major issue should be on the political persuasion rather than on the party label. My Republicanism was well known. I had been a participant in Republican politics for some time. And no newsman ever mentioned my name in an article without prefacing it with the term Republican candidate. And so my Republicanism was no secret to anybody. It was just that we were emphasizing persuasion rather than label. And I think that in Texas, because this was the right thing to do, because in Texas now people are coming to think less in party terms. They're coming to think less in terms of just voting for whichever the Democrat is, as to voting for somebody because of what he believes in or who he is.
Did you refuse the support of Mr. Nixon in your campaign?
No, I didn't refuse the support of Mr. Nixon in my campaign. As a matter of fact, we quoted his favorable comments about me on several occasions. I think there's a difference between refusing support and in determining who is going to come into the state and campaign for you.
Why did you not want him to come into the state and campaign for you?
We felt that he was embarking on this role of criticizing or serving as a principal critic of the administration, a constructive critic, I might add, that it might damage his effectiveness in that respect in Texas if he got involved in our campaign and became a campaign controversy or a campaign issue himself.
Mrs. McClendon.
Senator Tower, nobody was criticizing the administration more than you. You were against everything that Kennedy was for, federal aid to education, the farm program, the housing program. Maybe you'd like to tell us what you were for.
I'm for the preservation of our free institutions. I'm for the preservation of the traditional functions and responsibilities of the state. I'm for the preservation of a free climate for the conduct of business, for a market-controlled economy for agriculture. These are some of the things that I'm for. Therefore, I must necessarily oppose that which I believe to be destructive of the things that I am for. And well, that my party is in a minority now in the Congress of the United States, it is difficult for us to advance our own programs and secure their enactment. We have to oppose those things, I believe, which are destructive of the things that we do believe in. And I think that in opposing, you can oppose because you are taking an affirmative approach.
Well, sir, I'd like to go into this question of your being for farmers taking their chances in the marketplace. Are you for throwing off all controls and all federal help to farmers and let the cotton farmer go back to taking his chances on the weather and the boll weevil and get back to 5 cents a pound cotton?
This would assume that by throwing off controls, we would go back to 5 cents cotton. Now, I believe that these controls ultimately should be done away with. But, of course, I don't think anybody in his right mind would advocate just knocking the props out immediately, reducing all subsidization, all control immediately.
This is new with you now, isn't it? This is something different than you
No, do. No, it's not. As a matter of fact, I said that I consistently said this in my campaign speeches, that I believe that control and subsidization should be gradually reduced over a period of years until agriculture is ultimately returned to a market-controlled economy. And I did emphasize the fact on numerous occasions, because I probably would have been run out of town if I hadn't, that I did not favor doing this immediately, but gradually over a period of years, so that we would have some time for adjustment. Actually, in agriculture today, we're moving toward the large, efficient producer. This is a part of a historical trend. It's already been established in communications, in manufacture, and transportation. And I believe that the large, efficient producers ultimately will emerge as prosperous in a market-controlled economy. And two, we've learned now to apply science to the technology of agriculture to the extent that we're about to lick the boll weevil and even the weather.
Yes, but sir, what are you going to do with the big chain stores that come into the marketplace and sometimes they bankrupt a farmer in just a few days? Are you just going to let this happen without any control at all?
I don't know in what way the chain stores bankrupt
the farmer. I'm talking about the perishable vegetable problem in the Rio Grande Valley and in California, and the egg and poultry matter up in New Jersey. The farmer has no chance at all against these people.
Well, the farmer seems to want to take his chances. At least the consensus in Texas seems to be that farming should be returned to a market-controlled economy. And by the way, a number of independent grocery chains or Texas-based chains that are not large chains but regional chains seem to be doing rather well, and the independent grocerman doesn't seem to be faring too badly in Texas. And in the lower Rio Grande Valley, it seems to be prosperous in that area. Matter of fact, I carried the lower Rio Grande Valley. And I think that most Texas farmers, and I believe this is true generally throughout the United States, would like to get out from under government control. Actually, the direction we're moving in now is this. And I'd like to refer here, too, to a statement made by Mr. Kaufman, who is the economic advisor of the Department of Agriculture, to the effect that ultimately the production of food and fiber should be nationalized. Well, I think the farmer fears this now, and he begins to see the handwriting on the wall and feels that ultimately he will no longer be independent, but will be nationalized if we don't start turning back in the other direction toward the market-controlled economy.
Mr. Bryant.
Senator, four or five times during this interview, you've used the word preserve. It will preserve everything. You've said nothing about looking forward, which seems to put you in the same category as the Birch Society, the John Birch Society. Did you get the support of the John Birch Society?
I don't think that I got any formal support from them. A number of members of that society did support me, yes. But so far as I know, the society itself did not make formal support of anybody. I'd like to address myself to another portion of your question, and that is that I talk in terms of preserving, and I'm not looking to the future. Actually, this I think, is a misconception that we conservatives have got to clear up. We are responsible for it ourselves, because we have talked in terms of preservation and haven't talked in terms of what preservation means in relative to the future. We believe in progress. We don't believe in status quo or standstill. We believe in progress, in sustained progress, but that we think that progress can best be accomplished within the frameworks of free institutions. We believe that historically the American people have made progress and been free. We believe that people will discipline themselves as free people to do for themselves the things that they should and must do. We are advocates of progress. We believe that progress can best be sustained within the framework of free institutions. We believe that economic growth should be regarded as the achievement of a free people, and not as the function, the duty, the assignment of the national government.
We have about a minute and a half. Mr. Wilson.
Senator, you succeed a man who is very powerful in the Senate, Senator Johnson. very powerful with respect to committee assignments, even yet, as vice president. Do you think he threw any blocks in your way on getting good committee assignments in the Senate?
Well, my committee assignments have not yet been resolved. To my knowledge, he has thrown no blocks in the way. After all, he is a Texan. I think could be expected to want Texas to have as good representation as possible. And I might note that during the past week, he extended me several courtesies to myself and my family.
You don't think he's happy?
I don't know of any roadblocks that might have been thrown in the way.
Well, I understand Senator Dirksen has had some difficulty getting you what you want. What do you want?
Well, I think it'd be inappropriate for me to discuss that at this point. I think Senator Dirksen and I have discussed it, but I don't believe it's the sort of thing that we should kick around at this point. I think it would be a little presumptuous of me to start talking in those terms right now.
Mrs. McClendon.
Sir, did you participate in the Dallas mauling of Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson?
No, ma'am, I did not. I was not a participant.
You were there, weren't you?
I was present, but I was not a participant.
Well, how does it happen that you were not participating? You were a Republican who was anxiously working and waiting, watching with this group.
Well, actually, I was sitting there waiting over in a corner. And during part of the time, I was trying to protect my wife from some of the opposition who seemed to be pushing our people around a little bit.
At this point, I'm afraid I'm going to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
Thank you, Ned Brooks. We'll return with...